So, I think we will begin. Welcome to Prajnaparamita. I hope this is a fun class. I've been looking forward to it. We have a good group. And I think everybody's here right now, except for two people who are participating from a distance, one from Laos and one from Blatchley, Oregon. Hello.
Who's participating from Laos?
Stacy.
She'll be back in a month or so.
This is the season for Asian travel.
So this is it's one of the core seminary classes, so everybody who goes through seminary has to take this one. It's a prerequisite for some of the others, I think. The Wisdom Sutras are they figure prominently in, you know, how Mahayana developed and especially how Zen kind of came to know itself and be an entity in the Buddhist world. It's an important topic. Once you get familiar with this literature, you'll just like see it referred to all over the place in Zen literature. It's just, you know, just keeps coming up. Prajnaparamita is perfection of wisdom. The paramitas are, the perfections are these set of 6 or 10 virtues that kind of became elevated as the Mahayana developed. Prajnaparamita is kind of the ultimate one, although then they added some accessory ones that came after that. But this is really the most important one. And it basically refers to insight. I just want to kind of start there because, there's a couple of, Buddhism has a lot of words that are close to each other and little shades of meaning. So, you have insight, you have wisdom, you have prajna. They're kind of a cluster. So what I would say there is insight is a deeply understood experience. So when we really see through something, see the depth component of something that we're experiencing. So, does that make sense? So there's some, in this, lifting up that cup of tea, if there's an insight there, then I know emptiness in that lifting, right? For an example, that's a possibility. Lots of potential insights might happen, but that's the kind of, those are the conditions that would want to be there. Prajna often, as it's used, is referring to the utilization of insight. So it's not just that an insight happens, but that it is integrated, incorporated, digested, and it's then affecting who we are, how we act, what we perceive. So that interplay, that influence of prior insight is prajna, as it's acting. And then wisdom is, often talked about as being the opposite of delusion. So when we're not kind of stuck with the idea of self, as a continuously existing entity, or a permanence in general, or etc. So we could do that same thing with like consciousness and mind and attention and awareness, you know, kind of pull that cluster apart. We could do that same thing with emptiness and shunyata and thusness and suchness. That would be, for instance, that would be a great little presentation for someone to do on their 5 minutes, is take another of these and kind of decipher that little constellation of meaning. But my point is just that, like, this is the realm we're going into, and it's like, it'll take some focus. You know, it's easy to kind of meet this with kind of a broad brush and kind of gloss over stuff, and that's fine, and it takes several repetitions through this material to land it. But also, like, playing with that acuity dial, seeing what we can do to bring it into sharper focus as we go. And that kind of precision in thought and language is part of that. And part of the, you know, like this, the content for this class gets into a lot of non-duality. And it's hard to talk about, because that's what this class is about. We'll be talking about it a lot. We're going to, like, mess up a lot. You know, there's a lot, it's many, many ways to step off that tightrope. This is a seminary class, so it has a certain amount of academic and scholastic, you know, like, bent. But I also want to really keep it kind of alive and embodied. So I don't want to lose track of the experiential and the kind of applied part of this. So how this actually manifests in our practice lives. Because that would really be a disservice to why this is here. So, you know, like, allow this to be personal, right? Like, allow it to be direct, you know, feel free to relate experiences. I'm going to try to keep it moving in that direction as much as we can. And there's, you know, of course, there's some just, like, information exchange that will need to happen, but I'm much more interested in the kind of the liveness of the dialogue in terms of how we're relating to this. That's really, you know, like, talking about the history and whatever, like, that kind of stuff is just the medium for which we can get to that layer. So, with that in mind, I would say try to come to class as, like, ready for that as possible. You know, if you can, if your schedule allows you to sit beforehand, please do. We had a pretty full zendo tonight. That was great. I was happy to see. If your schedule doesn't allow you to get here on time for that, just when you come in, like, know that you're sitting, actually. Like, rather than setting up the room or whatever else might be happening, just come in here and sit. And then the rest of us will join you at 7:30. Let's see. Yeah, and so, like, during class, one thing I would, you know, as our mindfulness is kind of rolling through class, pay more attention to yourself, and then secondarily pay attention to what we're talking about. I think that will be useful. You can keep refreshing. Oh yeah, how am I? What's going on internally? How am I relating to this? Like, what? Like, where is self kind of sneaking in? Yeah. And part of that is like committing to prioritizing like who you are in this class. You know, that rather than, you know, what we know or so we're actually doing it rather than talking about it. Part of that is not implying or stating more than you've experienced, right? That's one of those, traditionally one of the really strongly worded taboos, like right up there was spilling the blood of a Buddha. And it's confusing. So there's some wiggle room there, but it's one thing to kind of understand about an idea, and it's another to really have felt it. And so, you know, we want to keep moving towards like the deepest knowing of it. And so clarity there is going to help that process continue. I think this is a pretty, like, we all pretty much know each other, more or less. And so this is a safe group. It's vulnerable not to know things, but if you gotta not know things, this is a great group of people to not know them with. Yeah. So I guess I'd like to go around and kind of get a sense of, something about how you're relating to the class, what you're hoping for or nervous about, or how you're, something about like how you're committed to like doing this, whether that's in terms of your meditation or whether that's in terms of like the assignments or the participation, like something about like how you want to hold yourself to it. Anyone want to start, and we'll go clockwise from there.
I'll start. So I like what you said about making it about experience. Mm-hmm. And I like what you said about insight, the deep understanding of it. I think for me, that's exactly how I wanted to relate to this class, because it's so easy to get tied up in words and concepts and feeling great because I understand something. Mm-hmm. So I guess thinking beneath that, or seeing beyond it, mm-hmm. or within it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I keep taking samurai classes because I have a hard time with words. I have a resistance to that sort of practice. Buddhism started for me as a body practice. Still, I think, largely is, but there's something that I know that this sort of thing helps, but I can feel the tension already in connection to it. So that's what I'll be working on.
Names would be helpful for me.
Great.
That's an okay addition.
Carrie and Suho.
Suho.
Okay, thank you.
I'm awesome. I said I'm not entirely sure. I have this desire to understand the words, mm-hmm. and I struggle. I just really struggle. And I'm hoping, because I know the way you teach is through body practice and through experience. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, I get a little bit more, like a little bit further than I otherwise would. So I'm hoping this combination allows me to get closer to my own practice. And now that we're in August, it's a good, nice time to give mm-hmm. this a shot.
I'm Haku Yu, and I'm hoping to, curious to see where it's going to go, really. So I guess some of it's not so much hoping to, my aspiration for this class is to be open to what shows up. I'm applying different pressure to my practice, and I think that this is really, might be useful to do that with.
Mm-hmm. My name is Sarah, and in these classes, I usually start off by feeling a little bit nervous about, like, the half an hour before I came over here, I was sort of Googling Wisdom Sutras, just because I didn't have a great grasp to begin with, but I actually am feeling pretty comfortable with where I'm starting and trusting the group based on past experience.
I'm Terry, and on the drive over here, I was asking myself this very question. Why am I here? Why am I doing this yet again? And I think for this particular class, I've heard a lot about Prajna Paramita. And I've been exposed to some of the concepts and some of the teachings. And for me, I think I want to, maybe I'm echoing everything that people have said here, but I want to make this material relevant to my practice and see what I gain.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I'm just here to kind of, I think tonight I'm kind of going through the motions. That's how it feels. I'm super jet lagged today. And I'm kind of irritated because I'm on the 28-year seminary plan. I keep having to take everything twice because I never do the project. So I think maybe I took this maybe 10 years ago. I took it, I don't know, but I have to take it. Cogan told me I didn't take this class. I tried to argue with him, but he swears I didn't take it. Anyway, so I'm kind of like, fuck. So I'm really, I'm here.
Thomas is back.
If you can find your old papers and turn them in.
Yeah, I didn't do them.
Go online.
I'm just being honest with you. This is an area where I get a little foggy kind of quickly. You know, the Paramitas and the this and the that, and it's just an area that I can tune out pretty quickly, mm-hmm. because I can get kind of confused in it. Mm-hmm. So, there you go. Oh, my name's Thomas. Yeah.
I'm Hoka. The first thing that came into my mind when you asked that question was that I was grateful in coming to this after having been through a lot of other classes and material. I feel like it's becoming more relevant to me as time goes by, and I feel ready now to take on something central as this.
I'm Francois Choquet, and I'm excited about this class because it seems like it's the core of everything we do here. I'm concerned that I'm not going to react to it the same as everybody else and kind of start getting it in a causing friction. So I'm really concerned about that. And and I'm also concerned about just coming out of it and saying, I didn't understand any of this. So that's where I'm at.
I'm Natalie, and I came here because insight and prajna also resonated a lot with me, that I feel like just often really overwhelmed with insight, that it opens a lot, and prajna is something that I have more trouble with. Like, right now I feel like some tension in my body. My heart is beating fast. My palms are sweaty. I'm excited. And also, like nervous because I love this topic so much that I'm afraid to put it into application and share it with people and talk about it because I don't want my ego to take a hold of all of this stuff. And yeah, so I kind of want to just like stay scared and quiet so I can protect the sweetness of the insight that's there. But no, I want to step in and I want to like talk about it and I want to I want to really open that up more. Yeah, still scared. No, I want to hide. Okay.
Jonathan, and yeah, that word excited keeps coming up, and that applies to me also. I'm excited to see how the words can come to life in my experience, in my life. In a book, it's pretty dry, but you know, how does this apply to the moment by moment? So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm Pam. Generally, in life, I have learned by reading and more the intellectual side of our culture, and much less the body spirit side of how it's possible to learn. So in order to sort of break that cycle a little bit, I've done some reading of introductory books, but I've tried to more approach it from the feel. So this is my first time approaching it from the intellectual study, and so I'm very glad to hear that we're going to also focus on bringing that back into experience, because it would be easy for me to get into that history and the translation nuances or the textbook stuff of what we may maybe getting into and not relate it back to the spiritual experiential side.
Well, I've been interested in the concept of prajna for a long time. I feel like it's a word that's been sort of spoon-fed to me quite a bit here at Dharma in my practice. And I was obviously pretty enthusiastic about the class when I signed up for it in November, and I was like the first person that signed up. but then January and February of this year happened, and I looked at the syllabus on Sunday, and I almost emailed Kakmu yesterday and said I wasn't going to do it because it just looked completely overwhelming. Then I looked at the syllabus again. I even talked to my husband about it and said, you know, if I don't do it, I'll have to wait 10 years to do it again. He said, well, that'll give you something to wait for. I looked at the syllabus again, and I actually kind of dived into a couple of the little presentation thing, and I took my millennial library nerdiness and went down an alley with that, and then the physical manifestation thing. I totally like jumped on that. So here I am. I don't know about my name's Colleen, sorry, and I don't know about all those writing assignments. That's that seems kind of overwhelming.
My name is Madeline, and I was particularly pleased with your description, Kagmyo, of the class, because it aligns very nicely with what my intention was, particularly moving to a deeper understanding this topic. I've been excited since I saw it on the website. I was like, hurry up and get here. I took the Five Ranks class with Jiko, and I think that really sort of was a little springboard into a greater interest in this topic. I'm very excited about the experientiality of non-duality. I'm very excited about it.
I'm Xinyu, and I'm here for the sheer pleasure of it. I'm not taking this class for credit. I've actually finished seminary, but I took this with Kyogen, and I don't remember how long ago it was, but I was, looking back, it feels like I was much younger in my practice, and when I discovered this, I was just blown away by it, and it was just like way over my head, but I was just so happy about it, and so happy that it existed, and so happy that I was in a place where people were reading this and talking about it, and I'm back for more. I'm not planning on doing any homework assignments.
You can mine. Well, it's not paid.
Great. So maybe there were a couple of comments about the syllabus. It would be worth putting that real quick. So if you don't have a Diamond Sutra and you want one, they're right there in front of Thomas. So attend and participate in all classes. You know, chances are people will miss one. I'm not worried about it. These are recorded, they are online. If you want to get it when you're not here, you can. That's kind of on you. So if you're here most of the time, then great. And if you know you're not going to be here, if you can email me some question or comment or something to like have you still participate in class, that would be great. And I may just have like a list of those because we have a couple of distance students, and so I'll work those into the class. The papers, these are all short, right? So I'm asking for five of them, but they don't have to be that long. And I think that I'm hoping that that's an easier bar than, you know, how it has been in the past, that you had like a 2,000-page paper and you had to do one of those on this and one of those on the Diamond Sutra, and it's like, you know, you really have to, set aside a weekend or two to do that. But this, you know, send me an email, you know, with, you know, a couple hundred words in it, talking about the reading for that week. You don't, you know, you have to do it half the time. So whatever one speaks to you, great. The presentation, I sent out an email with some possible topics. A couple of other topics that I was thinking about is, you know, doing a kind of study of the interlocutors, like Suzuki in this one, or there's a couple others who show up here. Subhuti in the Diamond Sutra, primarily. But just, like, why them, and who are they, and what does it mean that they ended up with that role here? Another one might be, we got those definitions that we started the class with, you know, taking some of those and pulling those apart. Another might be looking at there's a lot of lists in this, and kind of delving into that to some degree. So there's a lot of little possible topics. The main thing is I want it to be focused. I don't want like, oh, here's a like overview of the Prajna Paramita, like, you know, that we're spending, you know, the whole class on that. Like, I want something kind of specific that we're not, otherwise we wouldn't hit, probably. Sound good? And then the visual representation, you know, that could be, you know, copying the text. Not all of it, obviously, but, you know, however much you decide is wholesome for you to do. It could be a piece of art. It could be, you know, a lot of different things. And the subject of that could be, you know, like Prajnaparamita as a deity. It could be representative of that state of mind or an experience thereof. You know, like there's a lot of room for interpretation, however that is useful to you. But I'm looking for something that you get into, that it kind of lights a little fire, and, you know, that shows in whatever you come up with.
Does it have to be very coherent? Or can it be abstract?
Well, I'm not so concerned about that, as long as, like, for you it means something and you can convey that meaning.
We'll see.
For those legalistic among us, all of this have to be done by the end of those same classes?
Golly. Well, I'd like the art project and the presentation to be done by the end. And we're going to start with the presentations next week. So, because we've got, you know, what, 17 people in this class? So it's a lot to work through. So we'll probably do 2 a week and 3 a week at the end. So if anybody wants to go next week, please let me know. Get it out of the way. How are you? Great.
And so that art thing or the visual representation thing, you want us to bring that. Not just to you, but to the class.
I think we want to see it. Yeah,
okay.
Sounds like fun.
Okay.
How could you have you?
Like,
you haven't registered before tonight, right?
No, I registered a while ago. Like yesterday or the day before.
Okay. Huh. Interesting.
Did you bring ID with you?
No, but my mother's signed them though.
This isn't working anymore.
Kanya, there are two other instructors listed on the syllabus. What's their role?
Well, this.
Kind of came across that way.
So originally, Shintai and Fumio were teaching this class, and then in the fall, Fumio said, it's not going to work. So I stepped in, and then in the winter, Shintai dropped out. And so...
And then Jiko joined?
No, Jiko was always going to do like a class or two.
Okay.
So she will come in, and she'll teach the Heart Sutra for like the 6th and 7th class, I think. Or whatever, something like that, 7th and 8th. Kind of near the end, she'll do the Heart Sutra.
We still owe all of our assignments to you, not to all three teachers.
Right, you just send them to me. I'm the teacher for the class. Jiko's just going to, she's not going to come here for any other classes.
True.
She's going to come in and Heart Sutra at you and go her merry way. Yeah. Yeah, so each class is going to have some combination of like topics that I'm bringing, some presentations that you're giving, and then working through the text. So, especially for that latter part, you know, if you've read it and kind of done some digestion, so you have some ideas or questions or complaints, that'll make it more interesting. So I'm counting on that. So far, so good. How are we doing on time here? Okay. Well, this is kind of a setting the stage class. I don't know, has anybody started reading? Yeah, some about half. Okay. And how many people have taken this class before? You know, potentially, or oh, so not very many actually. Just a small handful. Okay.
Once or twice.
Great. Then I think I want to just talk a little bit about the history of it and, you know, sort of set the scene, and then next week we'll get into the text itself. And mostly next week we'll be on the first two chapters of the Ratnaguna. I mean, we'll, the reading is a little bit more than that, but realistically we'll spend most of the time right there. Oh, I wanted to mention the memorization. If you're doing, if your presentation is memorizing this, which I'm trying to do, either the first two chapters of the Ratnaguna or some, like the first five chapters of the Diamond Sutra, that's like a decent chunk that, you know, you can definitely get in 10 weeks, but, you know, yeah. It's a, you know, like this is how this tradition got to us, is people memorizing these sutras, and you know, so they're built to be learned in that way. So I like it. So don't have to. You've got lots of options, but it's one of them. And I'm right now I'm a little enamored of it. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about how you chose these particular translations?
Oh man. Well, yes. So Kanza is, I mean, partly this is what I was introduced to. And it's really like, you know, Kanza has translated so much. Like, he's just, like, he's translated more than anyone else. And by a long shot. And he's pretty well respected. He's, you know, he has several biases, and we'll get into those a little bit here and there. You know, he leads to, like, he tends to run towards the ontological interpretation, you know, in general. There's certainly other translations of this, but there's none that are as widely available, and I think it's just a good, like, kind of general purpose one. And a lot of people have it at this point, so there's a certain inertia in using that. I will bring in some material from other translations at times to kind of contrast. The Diamond Sutra by Red Pine, I don't know what Chico's going to do for the Heart Sutra. I don't have any idea. But I feel like most of you have recited that thousands of times, so I don't feel the need to assign any reading, and there's enough reading here in the Diamond Sutra that, like, you've hit your quota on pages. You're using Diamond Sutra by Red Pine because it's very thorough. You know, it's very readable. It's I think, you know, he got good reviews from academics, and having that whole kind of like string of commentaries, it's like you get like eight different lenses to look at it paragraph by paragraph, and you know, some of them are going to work better for you than others, and you'll start to recognize the different voices as you read the text and get to know, like, oh yeah, that's a Tao Suan, you know, comment, and, you know, like, whatever it may be, it'll start to coalesce. And I found that very useful in, you know, getting more comfortable, more familiar with the text. Okay. So, I've tossed around Mahayana a couple of times. That's, you know, so around a couple hundred years after the Buddha died, so there's a lot of disagreement about how this all started. It's naturally. We know that by 150 before Common Era, it was, you know, sutras were in place, at least beginning versions of them. The Wisdom Sutras, these span about 800 years of writing. So within this literature, the first one was around 100 before Common Era. The last one was around 700. And that the Heart Sutra was one of the last ones. The Diamond Sutra was actually one of the earlier ones, which Kanza gets wrong there. There's very little of the original Sanskrit that remained. Most of what we have is what was translated from Sanskrit into Chinese, and that was around 150 Common Era. Probably what happened is that there was a variety of movements. There was the very kind of traditional doctrinal cluster that was basically trying to keep things as it were, as it was. The more conservative, like in the Sarvastivadin. There was like 18 different schools that were all, today we would all call them all Theravada. And the, you know, Mahayana would call them Hinayana. It's a lesser vehicle. And in that milieu, there was kind of a series of different movements cropping up that started introducing new teachings, you know, other sutras. And they, of course, claim that these are not new, but that they were, passed along in secret, or this or that, or many different origin stories, but somehow tying it back to the Buddha. That was kind of the source of legitimacy, being the Buddha made that. I mean, that was a big deal, obviously. And so bringing in a new text was pretty dicey. You know, it was antagonistic. And so you'll find in these a lot of posturing and kind of defensiveness and like, this is why this is so important, and this is why it's so, like the Diamond Sutra is mostly talking about how great a person you'll be if you use this text. You know, that like in terms of like percent of verbiage, it's way over 50%. Is talking about how great the sutra is.
Yeah, it sounds like the Lotus Sutra.
but the reason for it is this context that it's kind of a it's really going in a different direction from the mainstream at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, by a couple hundred years, Common Era, Mahayana was more mainstream in northern India, and then as it spread out from there, that was what was passed along. The 8,000 lines was the one of the first of these, and probably the first two chapters of the Ratnaguna. The 8,000 lines has two parts. It's got the Ratnaguna Samkhyagatha, which is the verse version. So it's it reads like a poem. And then the Ashtasahasrika, which is the long part, is the prose version. And so the verse version came first, and that was probably the first thing that happened. as part of this literature. Over hundreds of years, they kind of got more elaborate and added more repetition. They kind of added like sutras onto each other to make bigger sutras. There were a bunch of kind of changes that kind of happened over time, like more emphasis on upaya, more abhidharma. Upaya is skillful means. Abhidharma is the kind of the psychology of Buddhism, this technique of breaking everything down into its, like all of one's experience down into its component parts for classification. More of the kind of sectarian aggression. The bodhisattva ideal became, well, it started getting pushed early, but then it became kind of more celestial, more transcendent, more, I mean, eventually the bodhisattva kind of outgrew the Buddha as kind of the ultimate rank. There's some kind of histories out there that sort of paint this as early Mahayana was kind of a series of cults around specific texts, specific teachings, and that's kind of how it developed, and eventually they started to coalesce and, you know, form a larger identity. Others believe that it was more of a reaction to kind of a reform movement against the existing Buddhism, which was getting more sedentary and kind of landed, like it was attached to place, and that Mahayana was really kind of pushing, you know, no, this is an ascetic movement, we are there's a lot of different there's a lot of research into this and a lot of theories about how it all came together, and I think the important pieces there are that it was a pretty as the two texts that we're working with in this class came together, it was early in that time of that development of who the Mahayana was, and so there's a lot of effort in this to place it within that context. So seeing it through that lens, it's important for understanding some of the extra. Like, why is this in here?
So if I'm a Buddhist before this, what is it that I'm... Just remind me what it is that I'm reading, or what is
Pali Canon and commentaries thereof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. After that, right. This is the next thing.
Yeah, and then you know, with this, you know, as this was happening, the Abhidharma was kind of kicking into gear in a it was expanding, mm-hmm. And so the development of the Wisdom Sutras kind of paralleled the development of the Abhidharma. So those kind of bounced off each other. Yeah.
Where does Nagarjuna fit in all this? Was he several hundred years after these texts, or is he really contemporary of these texts?
Sure. He's early-ish. So he was... he's not associated with a particular text. I mean, they're all, you know, they all refer to the Buddha as the speaker. But Nagarjuna is one of our ancestors. He's, you know, maybe 15 or 16 in from the Buddha. And he's most strongly associated with Majjhimaka philosophy, which is... pulls strongly from the wisdom literature, and one of the kind of mythological stories about Nagarjuna is that he's the one who found the wisdom sutras. So, you know, when the Buddha gave these teachings, he said, like, okay, that was really great, but nobody's going to get it, so lock these up. And he gave them to the Nagas. The Nagas are the dragons who live in the ocean, and they took them down into their domain and held on to them until someone was ready. And the Nagas noticed that, hey, wow, this fellow named Nagarjuna is pretty darn impressive. He's got the necessary chops. And so they invited him on down. He impressed them sufficiently, and they handed over the wisdom sutras. He brought them on back and started to teach them. So that's how it happened. Ta-da! So he's definitely closely linked.
So if he was working with these sutras, which ones, do we have an idea which ones they might have been?
I don't know. That might be a little topic to do a 5-minute presentation on. Exactly where does Nagarjuna fit into the development of the wisdom sutras? It's hard because most of what's written about him is about the Majjhimaka philosophy, which is a little bit later.
Right.
Yeah. And my guess is that this was happening. These were being developed and being used, and he was a bit of a product of that. But as people were, you know, a couple hundred years later, we're looking back, like, who's the shining star that we kind of pin this on? Like, that gives it the most credibility.
Right.
You know, this lineage the most... And that's where it landed.
Yeah.
And, you know, that... So, if you're in the seminary program, come back in the fall, we're going to do a whole class on Majjhimaka versus Yogacara philosophy in the Mahayana. So we'll get far into that. Right now, this is kind of the... you know, what comes before and kind of the fundamental part of it. The class of the fall is more the elaboration thereof. one of the books on Nagarjuna is called Elaborations on Emptiness. Oh yeah. Then the other thing about Nagarjuna is that both the Majjhimaka and the Prajnaparamita literature were kind of seen as, I mean, they're sort of radically saying no, right? They're radically saying, like, again and again and again and again, it's not that. I mean, the Heart Sutra is just a long list of no's, not just, but primarily. You'll find that throughout here. And what that is responding to is the Sarvastivadin, which was really the dominant philosophy of the time. And what kind of is characteristic of Sarvastivadin approach to Abhidharma is that they allowed dharmas, which are things, to be existent at different times. So not necessarily continuous, but in the past, in the present, and in the future, this dharma, like a pen or the thought of enlightenment, might exist, actually exist. And, you know, that's how they dealt with, you know, karma, basically. You know, that there could be action over time or at a distance or like, you know, how intent matters. And so that was their solution to that puzzle. And so, you know, you'll hear, like in this text or other sutras, they'll be, you know, throwing stones at the realists. That's who they're talking about, is the Sarvastivadins, those who believe that things are real. Okay.
Can we go back 1 second?
Yes.
So, some of the language in here is kind of making the point about credibility, right? Mm-hmm. Establishing credibility. And it was because it was radical at the time,
kind of out of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And this body of work was so out of the mainstream because it, why? What was it about it that was so out of the mainstream?
Because it's putting most of its energy into saying the mainstream is wrong. Right? It's not. This pen is not. The idea of enlightenment is not. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And just carrying that through to the extreme.
Okay.
Weren't the Orthodox doing the same thing? Saying their literature was...
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, you know, we're not studying that one.
No, it's...
As a good Mahayana Buddhist.
I've been listening to some podcasts about Indian philosophy, and I'm realizing just how so many other things were happening in this period also.
Yeah.
And so when I keep hearing it's this Buddhist sect responding to this Buddhist sect, and it's... had a feeling that it was actually much broader than that. It was,
for sure.
It was
a really rich tapestry, and like, you know, I considered like for the class in the fall or whenever we do history through text. That was last year, I guess. Trying to diagram some of that, and it's just too complex. I mean, there's just so much going on. I didn't have bandwidth for that.
Yeah.
But it's true. It's just very fertile ground there.
And is it accurate to say that these classifications that we make today, all these distinctions, weren't so clear at the time?
Yes. Yeah. Like,
it was just
like
lots
for instance,
of stuff bubbling,
you know,
up all around, and now in retrospect we say that was the this, and they were the that. But at the time,
for sure,
they didn't talk that way.
Yeah, and like the term Mahayana, it was like it predated the movement, and the movement was like there were like seven or eight different terms that described Mahayana schools, Bodhisattvayana and Ekayana, and like there are all these different versions of it, and Mahayana won out eventually. But that was hundreds of years into it that became kind of the brand name, right?
Trademarked.
Yeah, it was not a unified set of doctrines or propositions or teachers. It was multiple and diverse. Mahayana, by the way, you'll see references, especially in the first, throughout this, you'll see references to, there's a lot of martial imagery in here, like Yana as what it means is vehicle, but specifically like war chariot, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, that's what, you know, you would ride to battle in, and in the Upanishadic literature, that was that metaphor was like the war chariot was how you got to heaven. You know, so that was, in the kind of collective unconscious at the time, it was really clearly a metaphor for spiritual development and practice. And so that's how that term came about. Maha just means great. Yana means vehicle. There's alternative interpretations that say Yana is path, but mostly the way you find it is translated as vehicle. And you can find that, you can find references to Mahayana in the Pali Canon, but before it was describing the movement or the school.
Yeah. What was it describing at that point then?
It was talking, well, I'd have to go look that up, but I'm not sure. In the Janasi Sota Sutta is, that's where that shows up. So I have to read that and see, you know, exactly what that's pointing to. Yeah.
So you don't know?
I don't know.
Well, I wish I'd known that before I voted for you as co-abbot.
You probably send an email to the office. Cockmeal@dharma-rain. I'll take care of it. I'll put it in the right place.
I was just thinking it'd be a good project.
I could write those words down.
Carrie, did you?
Yeah, I was thinking it's just kind of funny. The vehicle. Because what is the vehicle carrying? It's all about knowing
something. Sure.
So it's just
yeah.
I guess there is no vehicle.
Probably not.
That's why they call it the vehicle.
Someone's read the Diamond Sutra. let's see here.
I have a little insight on the word vehicle to share. That, like, maybe it means flow. That it's not necessarily referring to something that's carrying something, because that implies duality, but in non-duality it's just movement of potentiality that and so with awakening that you kind of enter into that flow, into that movement, and so it's
which relates to the other understanding of it as being path.
There's a lot of duality in the imagery, which is, I think, hard. You know, like the this kind of war metaphor that it, like, you know, the Buddha against delusion, having this, some of his epithets are, it is very adversarial, and sort of underlining that either or kind of position, which it's also undermining, but it's, I think it's a, it's one of the hurdles in, like, using this, you know, as a tool in practice, is that so for myself, when I encounter that, like, I try to, and the reason why I gave you the historical background is so that it doesn't, like, so that you can kind of see why that's happening, and so you're not adding an interpretation that kind of diminishes this. But you can see that, oh yeah, there's a point for that. It's not just repetitive. It's not just propagandizing. It's, you know, like there's something more going on. And likewise with this, using these very dual either or metaphors, trying to see past that, like, why might that be happening there. It kind of creates the for myself, if I take as kind of the baseline that like this is at a deep level, this is really accurate and helpful. It may have lots of stuff and, you know, accretions the way to you and this and that and the other, but like if I keep kind of returning to that real trust in it, is more productive. You know, like I get more out of it. So to kind of to notice those like incongruities without getting like pushed off by them. And it'll bring that up explicitly in places. It'll say like, this is how people get freaked out by this. This is how people get overwhelmed by it when you hear about, you know, no self. This is how people get scared and throw up their arms and run away when, you know, someone explains what this means. And it's there's lots of opportunities to dislike this and hold it at a distance and like it's interesting letting it be more of a devotional practice in a way. That's why I wanted to do the, you know, like the art thing or the, like, you know, these other things that are trying to it's almost treating this as an entity, right? So
is the word Mahayana of Sanskrit origin?
I would say pre-Sanskrit, because it's coming from, I think I might have something about this written down, actually. It's the set. No, I didn't. But I have a reference for you if you're interested in that.
Pre-Sanskrit mean like
Prakrit or another Indic language. So it was, you know, the Jnana metaphor was definitely in use like long before Buddhism. It certainly didn't refer to, by the time it was referring to this endeavor, you know, the school of Buddhism, it was in Prakrit, which was the spoken language. The verse section was written in Prakrit, now this is another one of those places, and I don't remember how that went. But Khanza says one thing, and later scholarship says something else.
He was saying, if he said Sanskrit.
Well, what he says in here is that the Ratnaguna was written in Prakrit, and the Ashta was written in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit.
Right, okay.
But there's one piece of that which is not true. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember.
That would be a great talk.
it sounds like longer than 5 minutes.
Well, I'm glad that there's interest in these little... I think I have, if I remember that and I don't have it in my notes for tonight, then I think I'm saying something about that next week. So, we'll see. Unless someone else grabs it and wants to talk about it next week.
Okay, so I might have another, it feels like a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Please.
So, if Mahayana is lots of no's, it's resisting something prior to it, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's resisting the Pali canon.
Well, I think Mahayana pulls from the Pali Canon, but it's, I mean, it's not saying that that's not true. It's just saying that there's more, and what it's saying no to is some of the more kind of scholastic edifices built on that. Yeah. Mm.
I think it's kind of like if you took a hammer and you started hammering down all the walls. I see it more like that.
That's pretty radical.
Well, because what got me thinking about is, you know, we have all these things that build on top of one another.
Right.
Right? We still read the Polycanon.
Yeah.
We still get a lot out of it. And we put this on top of it, and then after this, we've got an awful lot of China, and, right? So, so that might be another, you know, another way of pointing, I think, what you're getting, which is this isn't resisted to something else; it's expansion of something prior to it. Yes.
Yeah, and I think it's like you know, like it's all pointing at the same, like. It's all trying to go to the same place, more or less, and it has different tools and vocabulary for doing that. Like the, you know, the Sarvastivadin is like, you know, I don't believe that they were, well, I mean, who knows? But my sense is that, like, what this is kind of holding up is kind of a straw man version of what they were really practicing, and that they probably had some pretty useful stuff in there, but that, you know, like, that was part of their system, and it worked in the context of their system, but it also kind of, you know, as this developed, there was another system, and it didn't work in that system. So it was using that. That was kind of a vulnerable global point. So it was using that as, okay, here's where we attack and show how good we are instead. So I feel like there's, you know, validity up and down, and it's a matter of like learning the textual languages, like learning like, oh, how does the Wisdom Sutras speak? And, you know, it's different from how the koans speak. You know, like there's a way to enter that literature and be nourished by it. And, you know, that they're different shaped doorways. And so, you know, hopefully in the next 10 weeks we kind of learn to recognize the shape of this doorway. Yeah. Sarah?
So you recommended that when we come up against something in the text that we feel, you know, some resistance or reactivity to,
mm-hmm.
that we try to make it more of a devotional practice, and I was just wondering if you could give a little more detail about like how you recommend that we approach that, because I know from past experience reading the sutras, I'm going to have those moments.
Yeah.
So what do you?
Well,
recommend?
So you know, you've got to you know, you're bebopping along, and you come across this like long list, and it's just like you can look at the page, and you realize, oh, it's just like, you know, it's just a list of stuff, and I'm not going to remember it. I don't need to know it. Like, where does the list end? Oh, it keeps going. Yeah, I'll just stick to there, right? So, you know, maybe that's just fine, but there's also a practice of, like, you know, letting that be a, like, just the mindfulness, like, practice of, like, going through it and, like, how, like, can I get a whole line before I'm lost? Maybe before I start to fuzz, you know, or kind of lose the focus. And like, if you take this on as a concentration practice, like, it's powerful.
That helps. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, you know, it's an option.
I found when I come across stuff like that, I try to think about, there's a reason that it's here, and, you know, I might not have access to the reason, but it's not just randomly here.
Mm-hmm.
I skipped to the end of the list.
I feel like it works on a different level. Like, if you stick with it, even if you don't understand what is going on, there's something there. that kind of trickles down. And then later, sometimes, like, a faith will come.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I, you know, for myself, doing this, like, there are times when I feel like that's accessible, and I, like, it's interesting to me. There's other times when, like, you know, it's just a lot. And so, you know, it's a matter of, like, you know, who are you? And, you know, like, attending to, like, the who rather than the content. And if you have that, you know, flexibility and willingness and resource at that moment, then, like, great. And if you don't, then also great. You know, you can do something that fits that self. You know, it's a matter of navigating, and the most important thing in doing that is you know, knowing how it's landing. So that, let that kind of guide you through this.
Sometimes when I come up against passages like that, I'm not relating to them, or I'm falling asleep or whatever.
Yeah.
I'll change the way that I'm reading them. Mm. Like, I can start walking around and reading it out loud, you know, or rapping it, or doing it, or shouting it, or, you know, something like that, or just, like, completely changing what I think I have to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, this is far-ranging, but I often wonder about the translator who translates those passages. And I wonder how they chose the words they chose. You know, some translations where passages are repeated multiple times, you'll just see an ellipsis. It's like, yeah, and you've read this before. So. But I'm thinking in the in the Flower Sutra, there are long passages, pages of a single sentence, paragraph, that you can just get lost in it, trying to understand rationally what the writer is getting at. And I think that it's also probably has something to do with the fact that it was an oral tradition, and which is probably why it works to speak it aloud, to try to get a sense of the rhythm, the, you know, and then it goes back to, well, did the translator really do a good job of getting that sense of the rhythm and the, you know, to give you a sense of what the sutra is pointing at. I don't know. I just bring that up because I think some translators try to do word-for-word translation, and it is unreadable. And others take a more poetic view. I think Red Pine is a good example of this. He really takes a much more poetic view of it and tries to capture the meaning, something that is outside the words, you know, the spirit of it or something. Yeah.
One thing that you know, we're not getting into here, we do with the Red Pine, but with this one, we're not getting into the commentaries, and that's really a huge part of it. And they're just not like, this is accessible because you know, it's been translated, and the commentaries mostly haven't been. So if you're not versed in Sanskrit or Chinese, you know, you're not reading them. But, you know, that's a real hindrance. You know, the part, like, to translate this, you wouldn't be able to do it without having the commentaries alongside it to kind of explain it. I mean, that's what Kanza says, so.
So the Diamond Sutra is 26 pages long.
Yeah.
And this is the commentary on those 26 pages.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, remember, there's like 8 or 9, you know, layers of commentary there.
Right.
Yeah.
Still.
According to Scientific American, it's the oldest printed text in the world.
Right.
The Diamond Sutra.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. It was lost for a while in a cave, and then recovered. But it predates. Well, I mean, obviously the Gutenberg Bible was movable type, but according to its oldest printed text in the world.
It's the oldest printed text with a date on it.
With a what?
Yeah. I mean, that we know of. Right.
One of the things I discovered in my Google search.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, do you mean printed like by hand or printed like through the machine?
It was reproduced.
Copies
of it.
Copy rather
than hand. Yeah. Yes, it's
fixed
type. As opposed to writing. Because before, you know, hand copies.
That'd be another great project, is that come up with a block for like the first like page of this and carve it out. Alright, I think we did it for tonight. See you next week.